a doubt in our minds, I don't think, but what the Lord Jesus Christ is the greatest leader in any way that we can look at this subject of leadership. Napoleon said that, I'll just read here what this quotation I have, Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and myself have founded empires. But upon what do these creations of our genius depend? Upon force. Jesus alone founded his empire upon love. And to this very day, millions would die for him. So when we say that we want to approach this from a semi-secular view, we are, of course, going to draw from the life of Christ all that we can. And there's a very excellent outline of leadership that we'll try to follow here in Isaiah 55:4, which I don't believe has been previously quoted in any of these sessions. In case you haven't memorized it, let me read it for you. Behold, I have given him for a witness, a leader, and commander. That's sort of a threefold outline. Christ, God's given him for a witness, a leader, and a commander. In preparing for this time, I accumulated all the different things that I could get hold of readily. And one of them is this little book that I haven't read all the way through called Keys for Christian Leadership. But I did look back in the back cover and saw that three people had something to say about this matter. And one of these reads as follows. One of the paramount needs of the hour in the realm of the Lord's work is leadership. There is a great mass of raw material in Christian lives which is covered with cobwebs of uselessness. This is lamentable, for every Christian is a potential ambassador for Christ. And the author of this quotation is Dawson E. Trotman, president of the Navigators. Quite a few historians have tried to analyze the science of warfare, and they've all come up with about the same conclusion, and that is that there are about 9 basic principles of war, and that the success of a leader in battle has depended upon how he was able to employ all 9 of these principles in the most effective manner. Now, in a similar way, a great deal of research has been done on the subject of leadership, and it has been decided that successful leaders possess about 16 attributes or qualities. And the measure of a leader is the measure in which he possessed and could employ these attributes. But we're only going to cover about 3 of them here this morning, and maybe leave the others for a later study. I didn't notice any clear definitions of leadership in the sessions that have gone before, so I'd like to borrow one and throw it out here to you this morning. I've got before me rather extensive notes that you won't be able to copy if we're going to have any lunch here. So I'll possibly go over some of them pretty fast, and maybe you can just get the gist if you want to try to retain them. However, on this one, we'll go slow. A definition of leadership. It is the activity of influencing people.
I think that's a good place to put a period.
I'll read the rest that's written down here, but I don't think it adds much to it. It's the activity of influencing people towards some goal which they come to find desirable or necessary. Influencing them toward a goal which they consider is desirable or, in case of war, is necessary. The science and art of leadership, I think, should be broken down into two broad categories, and those have already been suggested by Isaiah 55:4. And I would divide them into personal leadership and a military term would be command leadership, or an industrial term would be administrative leadership. So we're dividing it into personal leadership and administrative or command leadership. The distinction between these two might be expressed like this. Command or administrative leadership is the exercise of power over people, while personal leadership is the use and creation of power with people. When we think about leaders, we generally think of them in those two categories: power over people, the use and creation of power with people. Now let's contrast these for just a moment. In command or administrative leadership, there's only one interest, and that's the result. In industry, it's black ink on the ledger. In the military, it's winning the battle, looking for a result. A leader is given power over people in an administrative or a command position. However, in the latter case of personal leadership, it's personal leadership is equally concerned with the process in securing the result. Now we'll expand on that just a little bit. Personal leadership is known by the personalities which are enriched as a result of it. And the proof of personal leadership is the qualitative growth and maturity of the led, the people that are led by this leader. There's a difference between these two categories. You see, the person who has personal leadership has power with people, and they grow and are mature and are satisfied, and their best interests are fulfilled. There's a result end, but in the process, the emphasis is on the people. The people are the end of personal leadership and not some other result. Now, is it possible to be both? Many command or administrative leaders do not possess personal leadership, and we're all acquainted with some of them. They do get results, however. They get the desired result. But the people are an end, are a means to that result. While in personal leadership, the people themselves, the led, are the end. So it would be my conclusion that the former might not necessarily, that is, the administrator or the commander, may not have personal leadership, but the person with the quality of personal leadership is almost inevitably going to move into a position where that he will have to exercise administrative or command leadership. It's a natural result. In the scripture verse we've used, Isaiah 55:4, you notice that Christ is described in that order. I have given him a leader and a commander. So the person who's successful in power with people just can't keep from being thrust into a position of having power over people. Although there are many ways of securing a position where that we have power over people without having power with them. Now, at any time that anybody wants to break in and ask a question or comment or take a nap or take a walk, I just go right ahead. Now, I'd like to make a little side comment here. In this threefold description of Christ in Isaiah 55:4, he was first a witness. In studying leadership, I want to suggest just a little bit of a precaution here, and that is that we don't get into dogmatic about saying the only distance we can lead a person is the distance we've been. We can only take them down the road that we've been down. And that is true to a certain degree, but I think there's a cutoff point in this. And I want to give a horrible example here that I think the person who cooked this up, he really stretched a point, but maybe it'll help us remember it. I'll work up to it gradually. But for an administrative leader, there's a difference. He is not limited, I should say, to how far he's been or what he knows in his leadership. The distinction lies in the difference between the power to do a thing well and that of being able to judge when it is well done. An administrative leader or a commander does not necessarily have to know how to do everything. He is a witness and an example in many areas. But if he knows when a thing is well done, why, he has some of the quality. General Grant never learned to organize his personal life until he was given command of the Union armies. Lincoln knew what he was doing when he picked him. And immediately, the troops under which he was commanding were electrified as he took over. His three predecessors had retreated every time that the opposition got too tough. But one of the first things that he did when he took over command of the army, you remember that he said that, "I'm going to fight it out on this line if it takes all winter." That's the way that his army felt about it. But he didn't have a lot of the qualities that some of his predecessors had had. Now, I said I wanted to use a horrible example. Let's see if I can find it here. A man can say that a book is bad, though not knowing how to write one himself, provided he is a student of literature. And here's the horrible example. Though he has never laid an egg, can pass fair judgment on an omelet if he knows a little about cooking and has sampled some good eggs and detected a few that were overripe. Well, Aristotle said, he who lives in a house is a better judge of it being good or bad than the builder of it. You think he's right? So there are certain areas in administrative leadership where that the main another quality, in addition to having been down the road and being a witness to the people, is the ability to know when a thing is well done, even though he may not know how to do every detail of it. Well, we've said that leadership is the exercise of influencing others. And we could start from the first page to the last in the Old and New Testaments and find commands and examples of men and women whom God had called to influence others, to bring all the pressure and force of their personality on them. And so the great need which exists in the dearth of leadership that we hear about so frequently is in this realm of influencing others. But we want to work up to this gradually here now. Got another thought in mind. And I want to read a definition of a perfect leader. And I don't think you want to copy this down. It's kind of lengthy. A perfect leader so imbues his followers with the qualities of leadership that they will execute his will, comply with his demands, are eager to learn his wishes, and carry out his orders cheerfully, willingly, and even blindly. So there's only been one perfect leader. And Napoleon said that even today, 1800 years after he lived, he says there's millions that'll die for him right today. So Christ was the only one who was a perfect leader. I wonder if you have recently reviewed what tradition has to say about his early followers. In Fox's Book of Martyrs, he starts out with James the Great. And according to what's considered to be an authentic record, that as James was led to the place of martyrdom, his accuser was brought to repent of his conduct by the apostle's extraordinary courage and undauntedness, and fell down at his feet to request his pardon, professing himself a Christian and resolving that James should not receive the crown of martyrdom alone. Hence, they were both beheaded at the same time. The early followers of Christ would follow him without any limitation. Philip, the evangelist, was scourged, thrown into prison, and afterward crucified, A.D. 54. Matthew, the scene of his labors, was Parthia and Ethiopia, in which latter country he suffered martyrdom, being slain with a halberd in A.D. 60. James the Less, having been elected to the foresight of the churches of Jerusalem and was the author of the epistle ascribed to James in the sacred canon, at the age of 94, he was beat and stoned by the Jews and finally had his brains dashed out with a fuller's club. Matthias, who replaced Judas, was stoned at Jerusalem and then beheaded. Andrew, Peter's brother, on his arrival at Edessa, he was taken and crucified on a cross. the two ends of which were fixed transversely in the ground. Hence the derivation of the term St. Andrew's Cross. Mark was dragged to pieces by the people of Alexandria, ending his life under their merciless hands. Peter, having said that he was unworthy to be crucified in the same form and manner of the Lord, was supposedly crucified upside down. According to tradition, some people came to Paul, soldiers, told him that they wanted to believe and be baptized. This done, the soldiers came and led him out of the city to the place of execution, where he, after his prayers made, gave his neck to the sword. Jude was crucified at Edessa. Bartholomew was at length cruelly beaten and then crucified by the impatient idolaters. Thomas, the doubter, preached the gospel in Parthian India, where, exciting the rage of the pagan priests, he was martyred by being thrust through with a spear. Luke was hanged on an olive tree in Greece. Simon preached in Africa and in Britain, where he was crucified in A.D. 74. Barnabas, we don't know the details of his death, but he was supposedly a martyr. And so the Apostle John, the only one of that group who lived to die a natural death. So, in a sense, we do not aspire to leadership. But the only leadership that we can take is in leading others to be followers of the perfect leader, who was a witness, a leader, and a commander. So, in becoming a leader, we want to say there's only been one leader, one perfect leader. As followers of him, we may be able to lead others to be followers of him to the extent that they and we will execute his will, comply with his demands, are eager to learn his wishes, and carry out his orders cheerfully, willingly, and even blindly. So, let's take out some of these qualities as we move on here. And I don't know whether this is a real word or not, or whether it's been coined by somebody else. Let's put it down like this. The number one requirement for leadership in any realm is fellowship. And I want to read a quotation from an Armed Forces research project. And this is the conclusion to which they come. The psychologists assure us that there is a sound scientific basis for what enlightened leaders have long held to be true, that the first-class follower and the leader are one and the same. They say this is literally true and that tests prove it so. So the leader, the first-class leader, and the first-class follower are identical in the qualifications that they have. Yesterday afternoon, some of us were interviewing an Air Force colonel, a Christian man, and one of the people in the group asked him, when you are making report on an officer, knowing that what you say will affect his entire career and may determine whether he goes on to be a general or whether he is deleted long away, what's the number one thing you're looking for? And he said, it's the way that he's doing his job right now. whether or not I think he's going to be a general, is influenced almost exclusively by what he's doing right now. And of course, one of Dawson Trotman's oft-repeated statements was, you can tell what a man is going to do by what he's doing right now. One of Napoleon's principal political leaders said, there is no more valuable subordinate than the man whom you can give a piece of work and then forget it, in the confident expectation that the next time it's brought to your attention, it will be in the form of a report that the thing has been done. People in military life have long ago discovered that a military commander rises and falls according to the men under him. After a military officer gets to be a general or an admiral, he has the privilege of picking from anybody in the service who isn't senior to him, anybody that he wants for his staff. So there's really very little excuse for a general or an admiral not being successful, because he can pick from any place he wants to. That's illustrated in Scripture by old General Naaman. Remember when he came down to be the healed of his leprosy, that after Elisha put the proposition to him, that the Scripture records that he was wroth and went away in a rage. But his chief staff officer, who knew him real well, got him in the corner and talked to him a little bit. And then he went ahead and went through with Elisha's proposition, because he had a good man that understood him real well. And so probably the success of Naaman as a military commander was the man that he had picked to work for him. Now I want to read another statement here, another conclusion. It is therefore not an arbitrary standard for measuring leadership capacity in men which puts the ability to excel in assigned work above all else. And I'll read that again. It is not an arbitrary standard for measuring leadership capacity in men which is the ability to excel in assigned work is above all else. And that's exactly what Colonel Bruce told us yesterday. If men are indifferent to assigned responsibilities, they are bad risks for larger ones, no matter how charming their personalities or what the record says about their prior experience or educational advantages. So, fellowship or followership and leadership are exactly the same. They are identical. And the number one and all-encompassing standard by which we measure the leadership potential is whether or not a man is excelling in the task that he's doing right now. So, you and I know what motivates us to do the things that we're doing. We know whether we're doing our best and excelling, or whether we're covering up. If we're covering up, it's going to come out in some way. Well, that's the first phase of it, is this word. It's pretty heavy after coffee and cake, isn't it? You want to stand up for a minute? Wake up for a minute.
You can evaluate very easily in the military or in the business field. That's very difficult, I think, in the realm of the Lord's work.
I think it is, but there is certain fruit to look for. Is it not? Of course, the word hypocrite, I suppose, is used more in connection with Christianity than in... There's hypocrites in all phases of life, but they're most conspicuous in the realm of Christianity. But I think that there's certain fruit to look for. One thing is faithfulness, to see that if it's there. And then there's certain other things to look for that we who are in this group know right well what they are. And they exist or they don't. But the most of us are very accomplished hypocrites. Now this first matter we're talking about here is in two realms. The first that we just talked about is in the matter of excelling in the assigned task. And the other phase of it, I would designate as loyalty. In all the books that have been prepared on this matter of leadership, I mentioned the 16 qualities. Almost all of them place this at the top. Loyalty. There are not very many Christians today who can disassociate themselves with some already established Christian work. Occasionally, we find somebody that can rise up and be completely an individualist, but that's pretty difficult in this day and age. And so in the area of Christian work that a person's been called, the requirement to ever become a leader in that realm is loyalty to the leadership that exists. And that stands right up or right under this matter of excelling in the job and is really a part of it. About a year ago, on the glen here, I talked to a man that didn't seem to be making too much progress. At that time, we were in need of a little bit of financial rehabilitation. And I was talking to him about this matter, and he said, "Well, I regard this present difficulty as being a curse from God that's long overdue, the way that the finances are mismanaged and misspent." And so we progressed from there. "Well, what do you think about the leadership in general?" And as we went down the line, there wasn't anybody around that quite had the ability that this man had to really size up the situation and to put in effect what needed to be. Well, we promoted him to an area where that he could, he wasn't hindered in the exercise of the great abilities that he had been given, because he was somewhat frustrated here. But there wasn't any loyalty to the leadership. Now, I think we believe in our work that it's the Lord that promotes, and that no person can replace the leadership through a coup such as happened over in Iraq this morning, where that the king was dethroned and another government took over. You remember when Miriam and Aaron, wasn't it, that got together and criticized Moses' leadership? And boy, the repercussion of that was pretty bad, wasn't it? There was a dozen times, it seems to me, that David was better qualified than Saul to take over. But David recognized that he was the Lord's anointed, and he wouldn't let anybody touch him that was under his command. And later on, David, if there had been a popular election, I think he'd have sure lost in the last few years of his life. But one of the things, one of the prerogatives of spiritual leaders is the prerogative to be wrong, because that he's still right. When that he starts making too many mistakes, perhaps the Lord will replace him. But when he says that a thing is right, it's right whether it's right or not. You probably heard the conversation that took place between the high school girls. And one of them seemed to have all the arguments on her side in this matter they were discussing, but the other one wouldn't yield. And she finally said, "Why are you so obstinate? You can see that I've got all the evidence on my side." And so the girl who seemed to be losing the argument said, "Well, my mother says that that's the way it is. And if my mother says that a thing is so, it's so whether it's so or not." So, the leadership is, they have the right to make mistakes, but we do not have the right to fail to obey them because they've made a mistake. So that's one of the privileges a leader has, is to make mistakes. Because it's still right. And it's not right to disobey. So loyalty goes right along in here as a part of fellowship, as a requisite for administrative or personal leadership. I think it enters into both. If you ever ask a British official in this country or any place else around the world some question on the foreign policy of his country, he'll tell you this: we do not criticize our government abroad, and you can't get one of them to do it. They really make it hot for them at home, but they won't do it. To you couples, if somebody hasn't given you the hint, let me give you one here. Don't ever publicly or in the presence of any other person criticize your wife or your husband. You do that at home when nobody's listening, but not in front of the children or anybody else. It calls for loyalty when you're in the presence of others. Several years ago, the Navy found out who its friends were. And an Army general, under which I was sitting in a public relations course, said that this was the greatest exhibition of successful public relations that he had ever observed. And that was when the battleship Missouri went aground while performing an experiment for the Army. A lot of people don't know that, but that's what it was doing. They were running a detection range, which was a long ways out of the channel and weren't real sure where it was. They found out where it wasn't. But Navy public relations immediately got busy, and according to this Army general, he said immediately the whole attitude wasn't who's to blame for this, but how do we get it off? How do we get her back afloat? Because the Navy public relations immediately sent out all over the country for suggestions about what to do to get it off, to get her back afloat. And so the attention of everybody was focused on not who's to blame and how much is this going to cost, but how do we get it off? So the Navy found out who its friends were. So in this realm, there's excelling at the task, and that includes a complete loyalty So, leadership, if we aspire to it, are ever going to attain it, I consider that those factors are absolutely essential. Now, a person can have those and not be a leader. However, do a great job and be loyal, and every organization has got dozens of them. It's how that all 16 of these things are intermingled that brings out the result. But let's talk about another one here that's a requirement. And that is energy. A person can do a good job, be loyal, and yet not have a great deal of motivation. Now let me read another quotation. Almost every study of the secret of the successful leader has agreed that the possession of a generous and unusual endowment of physical and nervous energy is essential to personal ascendancy. Those who rise in a marked way above the mass of men have conspicuously more drive, more sure endurance, greater vigor of body and mind than the average. Now, there's three ways that we come into the possession of this energy. And the first one we can't do a great deal about, and that is our ancestry or inheritance, which means that everybody isn't born with leadership potential. There's a lot of people born with the necessary drive and energy that needs to be cultivated, but if a person is ever going to rise above his fellow man, he's got to have it. Now, another factor on which this is conditioned is the upbringing and nurture of an individual. How he's been brought up. And we try to teach people to redeem the time, don't we? And it can become a habit to redeem the time. And the third factor which contributes to this is the conscious use or abuse of our physical organisms from day to day. The conscious use and abuse, or use or abuse, of our physical organisms. Can anybody tell me what is sometimes considered to be a key word of the book of Mark? What is it? Straightway. That's it. Christ exhibited tremendous personal energy. So that when Mark wrote about him to the Romans, who were great admirers of people with drive, he just said, straightway, 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 straightway. And on they went. The leader's show of energy releases energy. It's contagious. General Patton, who was one of the most successful commanders in World War II, and it was for that reason that Eisenhower refused to fire him, said, in analyzing this matter of leadership, that the average person only utilizes 35% of his potential. The difference between a mediocre and a top-notch leader is what he does to cultivate the other 65%, which is sleeping and lying dormant. And one of the ways that a leader does this is by a show of energy on his own part. Several years ago, while President Eisenhower was in Denver, he had a little party, and it was time for the party to break up. People had to go home. And I guess all the women folks had gone to bed. And he said, well, here, let me call a taxi. And he picked up the phone book, and he fumbled for about 5 minutes with it. So finally, one of the gentlemen who had been at the party said, let me do that for you. So he took the phone book, opened up the classified section, and found a taxi. And he remarked to the president, he said, it might be embarrassing if the word got out to the people of this country that the president of the United States didn't know how to find the telephone number of a taxi in the telephone directory. I'm sure that at some period in his life that General Eisenhower knew how to use a telephone book. But his life was grew up as he practiced putting his energy to the things that were important. The greatest resource that we have is the resource of time. And when we talk about energy, we don't mean running around. And you could think up some good expressions on that. But directed energy toward a goal which knows how to evaluate the resource of time. When I was in the second grade, I think it was in a spelling book where I read, looked like a classified ad in the newspaper, lost. Between sunrise and sunset, 2 golden hours, each set with 60 diamond minutes. And at the bottom it said, no reward is offered. They're gone forever. So, directed energy, utilizing the resource of time, is absolutely essential. We only have a limited amount of time. What we do with that time determines how far up the scale that we're going to go. Now, that deserves a whole discussion in itself, is how to use the time, but we won't pause there. So in leadership, the ability to follow. The great leader and teach others. The task that we're doing, loyalty, and then energy, directed energy, toward utilizing the resources of time to convert time into the eternal is quite a job. But that's one place wherein lies the distinction. Now the third thing we want to discuss here is closely related, and I'll hurry up, and it'll be time for the KPs to go in about 5 minutes here. But we'll call this something that starts with C. I wonder what that is over here. Because I think I changed that at the last direction, and I put the wrong letter up there. Purpose. These overlap. In one of the previous sessions, Philippians 3 has already been mentioned, where that Paul said, this one thing I do. And in Isaiah chapter 50, verse 7, we know that verse real well. For the Lord God will help me. Therefore shall I not be confounded. Therefore have I set my face like a flint. And of course we believe that's talking about Christ. And God told Ezekiel the kind of a countenance that he'd give him when he went out to do his work. The statement is so well known that the author can't be identified, that the world stands aside to let pass the man who knows whither he is going. I don't think the author can be identified. The leader is one who knows with greater than average strength of conviction what he wants to get done and where he wants to go. A man by the name of Arnold Bennett said, "I think find the necessity for the tense bracing of the will before anything worthwhile can be done. It is the chief thing that distinguishes me from the cat by the fire." The setting of the will, the bracing of the will before anything can be accomplished. And the Frenchman, Balzac, said, "Conviction brings a silent, indefinable beauty into faces made of the commonest clay." Conviction brings a silent, indefinable beauty into faces made of the commonest clay. It's in the exercise of the will that the men are separated from the boys. Well, we won't have time to elaborate on this. We could give many illustrations. We talked about Paul. I had lunch with Bill Bright the other day, and very clear that one thing he has in mind, and that is a witnessing Christian on every college and university campus in the world. If you talk to Jim Rayburn, you'll find that he'll never be satisfied until every high school student has heard the gospel. The people that hit up Wycliffe are not going to be satisfied until every tribe has the Bible or a portion of it in their own language. And it was Dawson Trotman's belief that the world could be reached in his generation that led him into the research and brought him to the conclusion on which of which 2 Timothy 2:2 is one of the verses we use. Reproduction, multiplication. He believed that God had commanded that it should be done, therefore it must be done. And he set out in his work on that basis. Now, of course, we've got to be careful here on dogmatism. We can really get obnoxious if there isn't love goes along with this. So you see, that's one of the places where we'd need to intermingle one of the other 16 attributes, which we can't discuss. But it's got to be there. And if you and I don't have a conviction, I think it's about the time that we prayed that the Lord would show us, if he will, exactly what his purpose is for us for the present, if he won't reveal the whole plan for the future. Now, in conclusion here, and this isn't one of the 16 things, but I just want to mention the hazards of leadership. The reason that a great many people, particularly among Christians, do not attain to it in any degree. If the Lord gives a person the privilege of leading another to Christ, he has to be very, very careful that he doesn't become disqualified through taking some of the credit. And I consider that there's a striking lack of humility in our own group as we talk about our men, and that I'm a trainer, and the training that I do. And just as soon as we're able to do it without the Lord's help, why, then we're training a different kind of people. A great lack of humility, because Proverbs 16:18 tells us, "Pride goeth before a fall, And Timothy said, don't put a novice in charge, lest he be lifted up with pride and fall into the condemnation of the devil. We're not ignorant of his devices, are we? And James 4:6 says that God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace to the humble. So the greatest hazard of leadership is when that, having sampled a little bit, the love for power comes in. And let me read another quotation. The desire for enhancement of the essential ego of every individual is one of his central driving motives. Personal enhancement. We can't get around that. That's a primary drive in every one of us. One which colors and influences all behavior, and one which is, of course, natural and essential. All of us have to register to stand well in our own eyes, to attain a sense of individual worthwhileness. The leader naturally gets an exceptional opportunity to satisfy this urge through the exercise of leadership. Then, here's what happens. The leader may consciously enjoy a feeling of superiority and aloofness, showing itself in condescension, vanity, conceit, self-pride. He may depend too much adulation and personal loyalty, and therefore try to surround himself with yes men and rubber stamps. He may want his own way too much and too often, and be too opinionated and obstinate about taking counsel with his colleagues and followers. Everyone is familiar with individuals who elevated to posts of leadership show these characteristics to a greater or lesser degree, and so on and so on and so on. Christian leaders have this temptation, I think, above all others, because there is a subtle coming in where they say, the Lord has blessed me so mightily, how can I be wrong about anything? On the basis of the past blessing, I can't be wrong. And the exercise of power over people replaces the exercise of power with people. And it's a real hazard. But knowing that it could come and being prepared for it is one of the ways to qualify for a greater precision of influencing others. Well, this takes a whole semester to talk about, doesn't it? I think I'm going to quit. Some of you already have, 10 or 15 minutes ago. We put a lot of stock in Gregory's laws of teaching. I remember one of the things he said is that you might as well try to teach after people have left the room as after that they've left off their attention. Well, I don't know whether this will stimulate anything in your mind or not, but I think it's worth considering that Christ is the only perfect leader. Witness, a leader, and a commander. If we're going to influence others to come to him and follow him, we've got to develop this art of excelling in our job and of being loyal. We've got to capitalize on energy, have purpose, and beware of the hazards. Bill Green, will you lead us in closing prayer, please?